Hey, so have you heard the rumor that the restaurant guys are introducing a call-in component to the show? Well, guess what? It's true. So if you have a question for the restaurant guys or something you'd like us to discuss on the air, call us at 732-828-9459. Call anytime from anywhere. We'll answer your questions and who knows, maybe even have you on one of our upcoming Restaurant Guys call-in shows. The number to call is 732-828-9459. 732-828-9459 from anytime or anywhere.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us through WCTCAM or restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Hey, good morning there, Mark.
Hey, Francis, how are you?
I'm just ducky, thank you very much.
Yeah?
I'm just ducky. Yeah, it's funny. Mark is looking at me a little oddly because I rode my motorcycle into work today, and so I have prescription motorcycle goggles, but my glasses I left at home, and so the only I'm sitting in the radio station with motorcycle goggles on.
So for those of you who think Francis looks a little dorky normally, he's got the volume turned all the way up today for sure.
Well, you know, we wanted to talk today about something that's been in the we've talked about it before, but others are starting to comment on it as well. And there's a situation that's gone on in New Jersey where the New York Times, they've always had, and we've talked about this once before on the show briefly, but the New York Times has always had one set of ratings for the their national section for the New York restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
And they also have, if you live around here, if you live in Long Island or New Jersey or Westchester, there are regions of there are sections of the paper that come out on Sunday that are for us.
Regional.
That are regional.
It's called the Metropolitan section.
And they have local restaurants reviewed there under a system that's very similar. Instead of 1, 2, 3, and 4 stars, it was good, very good, excellent, and extraordinary, which everyone understood as being
the
outer borough equivalent of 1, 2, 3, and 4 stars. Well, that's changed in their wisdom. The folks at the New York Times have decided to give us a new rating system, and people are pretty pissed off about it. And the new rating system in the New York Times for all the new restaurants is don't miss, worth it, okay, or don't bother.
That's awful.
Really? Really?
That's awful. And okay.
Really?
And actually, they came out, okay was something else, and they changed it to okay. I don't remember what it was, but it was awful. Actually awful.
Really? And okay, so what they've done is they've taken us from a four-tier system of, you know, 1, 2, 3, you know, to be a one-star restaurant, to be a new, you know, like little bistro or something, and get one star from the Times, that was a positive review.
It was a real deal.
It was a star. They also used to have satisfactory, and occasionally they'd have poor.
Mm-hmm.
You really had to piss them off to be poor. You had to piss them off so much that they didn't say, let's not review it. They were like, no, this is so bad that we got to warn people away from this. But so...
So now 1 star is don't bother.
1 star is...
2 star is okay.
No,
okay.
Well, except that what they've done effectively is don't bother is a poor. They've
right.
Kept poor. So you only have 3 levels of good, and one is eh. You know?
One isn't even eh. It's okay.
It's okay.
It's okay.
Would you go to a restaurant and say, hey, what do you think of that restaurant?
Oh, I remember what okay was. It just came to me.
What was it?
Do you remember what okay was when it first came out?
No.
In a pinch.
In a pinch! So you had 2 negatives and 2 positives, and the positives were worth it and don't miss.
Worth it. I mean, what a horrible... A New York Times 3-star review became a worth it. Now, obviously, I've seen the reviews that have come out. They're devaluing their own review. They're devaluing their own credibility and worth, okay? The New York Times restaurant review is really, it's no longer worth it.
It's no longer worth it. Don't bother. But I just, how could you heap more disrespect on a state? And here's the deal. New Jersey's dining scene for a long time, you know, it's we're not as good as New York City. It's not as good as, but it's getting better and better all the time.
Some really terrific restaurants in New Jersey.
And
some world-class restaurants are located in New Jersey.
All I want to say.
Whether you think mine is or not, you have to say there are world-class restaurants in New
but
Jersey.
I remember when we got our 3-star review, and here's how it worked for a long time. There were no 4-star restaurants operating in New Jersey for a long time, and then Nicholas got 4 stars. And there was one restaurant that got 4 stars, but then they changed chefs and they fell back away. But there was one 4-star restaurant in New Jersey. There were a few 3-star restaurants in New Jersey, which are, you know, up there. We had our restaurant was 3 stars, is 3 stars, and will forever be 3 stars because you can't review me anymore because you've taken that away. So I am always 3 stars. But then you had, you know, a bunch of 1- and 2-star restaurants in New Jersey that ranged from, you know, little ethnic eateries to, you know, a great hamburger joint would be my 1-star joint if it was really good. But now, what do you have? You have okay, worth it, and don't miss. First of all, if I get an okay, that's not 1-star. That's screw you. I mean, that's
right.
I don't want to. I would never go to Russia. Hey, what do you think of that restaurant? It's okay. Oh, I got to rush over there.
Yeah, exactly. I would never go to that restaurant.
And I'll tell you what else. If I said to you, well, what did you think of the restaurant that you went to last night? You said, that's worth it. I wouldn't go to that restaurant either. So what you're saying is there are 3 categories that you ascribe to that most people.
That say don't go to this restaurant.
That say don't go. And there's one that says don't miss it. Are you kidding me? All right, well, there's a guy in the Artful Diner. There's a guy named Art Namendorf who writes on the NewJersey.com blog and has the ArtfulDiner.com. And he's a restaurant reviewer mostly online. And he's really smart. He's really, you know, he's really in tune with New Jersey for a long time. And he passed on something. He posted something that he received from the owner of Za restaurant in New Jersey in Pennington.
Down in South Jersey.
Mark Valenzana. I've never met Mark.
Valenza.
I've never met Mark Valenza, but I like him.
When Mark printed this article, I gave him a call and just gave him kudos and said, you know, we support you 100% on this. And he responded, I think, in a great way to a really dumb decision by the New York Times.
Here's some excerpts from his letter to the Artful Diner. Open message to the New York Times. The New Jersey food reviewers for the New York Times had a respectable star rating system. Recently, however, the New York Times has abandoned the star system in New Jersey for the following new ratings. Don't miss, worth it, okay, don't bother. Apparently, and in quotes, Joy Z restaurants don't merit any serious culinary respect. No more don't bother, okay? Show of hands, how many people want to rush over to an okay restaurant? And if a restaurant's really deemed don't bother, why are you bothering to review it? And I think those are some really good points.
I totally agree.
2 negative reviews here. You're telling us how bad the restaurant scene is in New Jersey? I can find you good restaurants. I can find you, and the reviews come out once a week. I can find you 52 great restaurants worth reviewing a
year.
And
the other thing I'll tell you is the restaurants in New Jersey are getting better and better and better and better.
And what he says is, and what is this don't miss? Why? Is the restaurant about to close? Is that what it is? Don't miss means it's going to close? So he's insulted, and so is every other restaurateur in the state of New Jersey. I can't believe how the Times got this wrong. But he has a top 10 signs the New York Times new rating system may not be working. And some of them are kind of funny and funny for Indecideders. But his number 10 top 10 signs the New York Times rating system talks, basically, is the top rating, don't miss, includes the word don't. It really should never be your top rating. And the number one reason
just
is...
Just like my... And you know, same rule. Never go to a restaurant that has factory in it.
Yeah, exactly.
Same principle.
I don't care whether it's a tomato factory or a cheesecake factory. I don't want it. So, and the number one, his number one on his list, we'll cut right to it, and this I freaking love. Jerseyans will prefer, really, the mob rating system. Why don't we go to the mob rating system? Best would be... to die for? Well, is it the Jersey Housewives mob rating system of restaurants in New Jersey? To die for, freaking great, good as mom's, and forget about it. And then we add a new negative one. Are you freaking kidding me? I think that's what the New York Times should show. They really think of New Jersey. To die for, I'm going.
All right.
How was that restaurant? Freaking great. I'm going. How was ever good as mom's? I'm going. It's not freaking great, but I'm going.
Yeah, I think I would change on freaking great to unfreaking believable. I think that's.
That might be better than to right below to die for. You might have.
Oh, you're right. I have
there.
To move that up
I
to the
think,
top.
Yeah,
maybe 5 stars. We can make that one 5 stars.
But forget it. Forget about it. And you know, forget about it. He's like, oh yeah, forget about it. You know, maybe I'll go if I'm in a pinch. I'll go. And are you freaking kidding me? Is perfect. Is really perfect. So if you're gonna like give the finger to all New Jersey restaurateurs, New York Times,
right,
let's do it with a little bit of humor, a little bit of aplomb, shall we? All I have to say is forget about it. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC-AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, and our guest today is Dave Broom. Dave has written the World Atlas of Whiskey. It's a comprehensive look at whiskeys around the world like I've never seen before.
Dave, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, guys.
You know, that was kind of an ambitious title, the World Atlas of Whiskey, but it's pretty much fulfilled it fulfills the promise of its title.
Well, that's very kind of you to say so. Yeah, I mean, it was a little bit daunting when the publisher said to me, well, yeah, this is going to be the World Atlas. But, you know, it follows on from the same publisher's other books, it's like the World Atlas of Wine and various other things. So it is part of an ongoing drink-related series. But yeah, I think it was only when I began writing it I suddenly realized how many whiskies there were in the world. So it's a big undertaking, but it was good fun.
Here's a fun fact. How many whiskies did you cover in your book?
That's a good question. And one, I really should have these figures at the tips of my fingers. But if you take, for example, there's 96 distilleries in Scotland alone, and I tasted all of them, sort of three or four, five expressions from each of those, plus then everything in the US. So I was the major distillers going, quite a lot of craft distillers and all around the world. The book says over 350 tasted. I reckon it's pushing 400, 500 tasted.
Well, you know, I think the whiskeys that you've given tasting notes for are fascinating. But the book is more than just a sort of a list of wines tasted. It's comprehensive in maps, topography, history. You know, it's really, if you want to know about whiskey in the world,
distilling.
Yeah, it's pretty
the
amazing.
Process.
Well, the idea had been kind of in gestation for a few years. Really, you know, I'd done a couple of whiskey books, and I was kind of looking around for an angle, actually, because there's an awful lot of whiskey books out there. There's a lot of good whiskey books out there. I didn't just want to replicate what I'd done before. And it's kind of long been my argument, really, that the best way to teach people about whiskey and, in fact, to learn about whiskey is through flavor. So when this opportunity came up to do a World Atlas, it was a chance to do, well, let's fix these distilleries physically around the globe, but let's also start talking about where the flavor map goes as well, and let's try and sort of map them in that sensory world as well. So that was kind of the starting point for me, which then brings in, rather than having a history chapter, you might as well sort of tell the history of whiskey through its flavor and sort of just lead people through gently. And, you know, it's about why whiskeys taste the way that they do, really. There's an awful lot of good books out there which tell you what whiskeys taste of, but I really don't know of any out there, to be honest, that actually say, well, this is why they taste the way they do. And, you know, if you like them, here's another one that tastes around the same, and, you know, you can really start exploring.
You know, I think one of the things that is really fascinating, Mark alluded to before, is you talk about the distilling process and you talk about it in depth, and you talk about it, and I think this was fascinating in the book, because I haven't seen this in books for consumers very, very often. You talk about how the different choices a distiller can make during distillation will affect the flavors in ways that, like, I mean, everybody sort of assumes that if you age it longer on more charred oak barrels, it's going to be darker and have more caramel, and we know that age will affect a spirit. But you deal with things like copper, like how much copper is in a still, what kind of copper is used, how long a wort is it or the distillate is in contact with copper, and how that affects the whiskey. I thought that was phenomenal. Would you talk to our audience about that as just one of the variables?
Yeah, sure. Maybe, you know, the starting point really is that, you know, if you're taking like Scotch whiskey, it applies to all whiskies really. But, you know, if you're dealing with Scotch single malt, for example, you know, all these 96 distilleries in Scotland are all doing exactly the same thing in principle, but they've all got their own little tweaks and techniques and decision points about which they've taken. And, you know, one of the most important things is, you know, the shape and the size of the still, and ultimately how much copper there is within the still, because copper likes heavy stuff. Copper holds drawn to heavy elements like sulfur compounds and you know, things that, that you know, aren't necessarily wonderfully smelling. So the longer the conversation between the vapor and the copper, the lighter your whiskey is going to be. So, and that can be, you know, a big tall still will have lots of copper, so there's a long conversation. So the likelihood is that big tall still will make a lighter and more elegant whiskey, and conversely, a smaller still will, because there's less copper, is likely to produce a heavier spirit. It's not always necessarily as clear cut as that, but you know, the whole element of copper is fascinating. But you know, it makes it sound dreadfully techy, but it's not. But it's a good grounding to have. You know, that you know, next time you walk around the distillery, you look at the size of the still, and you can ask relatively intelligent questions and go, "Ah, how long is the conversation going on there?"
You know, this is the copper issue. Obviously, is very, very interesting issue. But I think I want to go a little more basic than that. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, how certain regions got their stylistic? You know, how did Irish become Irish? How did Scotch become Scotch? And then, you know, maybe the different regions of Scotland became different from one another.
Sure. Well, maybe deal with Scotland first. I'm not. Part of the book, actually, one of the main things in the book really was to try and dissuade people from the notion that simply because a whiskey comes from the Speyside region, it automatically has to taste a certain way. I think that's kind of overly simplistic, to be honest. You know, whiskey doesn't operate in the same kind of regional way as wine does. Each individual distillery is what is important. But, you know, you can say that there are general flavour camps, if you want, across Scotland. Take the island of Islay, for example. You know, on the island of Islay, and all the islands in the Western Isles of Scotland, there are no trees. You know, there are no oil rigs offshore at the West Coast. You know, so back in the, and certainly not back in the 18th century, 18th, 19th century, so that when the early whiskey natives were making their whiskey, they had to dry their barley somehow, and the only indigenous fuel they had was this stuff called peat, which, when you light it, gives off this wonderfully fragrant smoke, which then inveigles its way on into the barley and therefore into the whiskey. So the whiskies and the whiskey makers of the islands began to specialise, because that's all they had around them, making smoky whiskies.
And I just... Well, I just want to point out for the listeners who may not understand what peat is. What peat is, it's sort of semi. It's peat or turf is basically grass that has been cut up, and the soil is so rich with organic material that when it's dried, it will burn, and it burns in a very fragrant sort of a way, and that's what peat is. And people use it to heat their homes in that part of Scotland and in Ireland. And when there are no trees, it's an inexpensive, though very smoky and dirty fuel. That smoke, by dirty, I mean it doesn't burn cleanly, but because it doesn't burn cleanly, it's very fragrant and aromatic, and that's where, you know, that's the signature of some scotches.
Exactly. You know, it is kind of baby coal.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and there's different sorts of peat across Scotland, depending on what the vegetation was over 5,000 years. So the peat in Orkney, for example, in the north of Scotland, where the story of Highland Park is, for example, is a very heathery. You know, it's made up of decomposed heather. And when you light that, you get a completely different aroma to the peat that you get in Islay, where the vegetation has been different. So yeah, there's lots of different smokes around Scotland. I mean, I'm dealing with the whole flavour thing then, that, you know, the island whiskies, by necessity initially and then by choice, became known for being smoky, which liberated the distillers on the mainland, especially when blended Scotch appeared and blenders were blending lots of different flavours of whiskey. You know, they wanted various different flavours of whiskey. So therefore, on the mainland of Scotland, distillers began to look for different styles. So less smoky, more light or more fruity, or perhaps more dry and malty. So there was greater variation in flavour profiles on the mainland of Scotland. A lot of it simply driven by the needs of the blended whiskey market. Some of it driven by, you know, One of the interesting things I kind of stumbled across, and I'd never really thought about before.
I'd imagine in writing a whiskey book, there's a lot of stumbling involved.
there's a huge amount of stumbling. I'm breaking a glass.
Exactly.
Yeah, and waking up thinking I had a really good idea last night. I wish I could remember it again. what I worked out was that if you look at the distilleries which were given the license at the beginning of the 19th century when the modern whiskey industry started, the vast majority of them, with the exception of really only two in Speyside, all continued to make a big, heavy style of whiskey. So big, earthy, meaty, rich, powerful whiskey, like Macallan, for example, or Glenfarclas.
Love
or,
them.
Craganmore or Inverness or Mortlach. You know, these big early whiskies remain big and solid and rooted in the earth. Whereas the distilleries which are founded towards the end of the 19th century, because the blenders didn't need so much big, heavy, earthy styles, tended to make a lighter, fruitier style. And the distilleries which are built in the 1960s, the big gap in distillery building, all tended to be sort of lighter and more dry and malty. So it's almost like three ages of flavour which existed within mainland Scotland. And sort of discovering that kind of just opened up a whole new area and a whole new way of looking at flavour and looking at the way whiskey has evolved and why whiskey has evolved in the way in which it's done. So it gave me a new way of exploring the flavour.
Let me jump in here and see if we can use what we've learned and if I can pass the quiz. The lighter styles of whiskey would have had more copper in the stills, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
what,
well done.
And thank you very much. I passed.
Dreadfully patronizing. Sorry, hang on. Well done. Yeah.
No. I meant that. I meant that totally in good humor.
And Dave, you should know that Francis does much better with patronizing, so that actually works for him.
So, all right. So, but what else? Would the modern distillers who wanted to make a lighter whiskey in the same place, they're going to introduce more copper, they're going to have a longer contact between the spirit and the copper. What else do they do to make a lighter whiskey?
To make a lighter whiskey, the initial thing, your initial decision point is, do you want to make it smoky or not? So you would tend to take the latter option of saying, I don't really want smoke in there because I want fragrance and delicacy and grassiness or fruitiness or whatever. So there wouldn't be smoke involved. So no peat used in the malting process at the very, very beginning of whiskey making. The second option is when you grind up the barley. The barley's been malted, so it's got lots of starch in it, and you want to get the starch turned into sugar. So you add lots of hot water to that, and that triggers enzymes, which then converts the starches into sugar. If you, and that's all done in a big tub called a mash tun, uh-huh. And that's, you know, the sweet water, sweet liquid is drained off the bottom of the tub. If you do that draining process quickly, you pull through some of the husks from the ground up barley, and therefore your whiskey as a result will have that kind of malty, dry character. So if you wanted to make light, you would do it very gently because you didn't want that malty character. Then in fermentation, you would want the fermentation to be really long, so that's like 4 or 5 days, 60-70 hours. And that helps promote all these more fragrant flavors within your whiskey. And your distillation would be relaxed and involving lots of copper. When you're then aging your whiskey, you don't want to put it into big, heavy ex-sherry casks, which would just, you know, swamp that fragile little thing that wants to be skipping gaily through the meadows. You know, you want to put it in a refill cask, you know, where there's wood, but the wood isn't going to be oppressive and dominate the whiskey. So there's a whole number of these decision points that a modern day distiller will take. A lot of it sort of learnt by rigorous science these days, but a lot of it basically just handed down from generation to generation. And the industry, is great at now understanding what goes on in order to control what has always happened, if you see what I mean.
So a lot of times it's a distiller's decision. A lot of times it's decided by region and what's around you. But also sometimes there are socioeconomic factors in a style of whiskey. You know, Irish. Tell us a little bit about how Irish
yeah,
whiskey
sure,
style.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, the perfect introduction to Irish whiskey. The Irish whiskey, which we know of today, you know, the big brands, you know, such as Jameson, you know, the classic example, you know, Jameson or Paddy or Powers or Redbreast, the fantastic Redbreast. Really were urban whiskies. They came around at the beginning of the 19th century when capital was being introduced into distillation. As a result, if you look back at the 18th century history lesson, there was lots and lots of small distillers. There was binge drinking, like, you know, legislators were going, you know, ballistic, trying to control the amount of booze which was being consumed on the streets in Britain. And they tried various ways, and they realized eventually that introducing capital and, you know, and allowing serious investment to be brought into the distilling industry would actually be a way of trying to improve quality, and et cetera, et cetera. And the Irish distillers really the Irish distillers grabbed hold of this, and they built themselves huge distilleries, big commercial distilleries. You know, John Jameson, you know, massive distilleries, great big pot stills as well, which would automatically produce a lighter style because they had more copper. And they triple distilled as well, which again would produce lighter whiskies. And the one issue when they were producing this vast amount of whiskey was that the government then realized, well, hang on, we can make even more money at distillers if we tax the malt that they're using, the malted barley. And the Irish guys here are producing huge volumes of whiskey, so it went, well, we don't really want to pay an awful lot of tax, you know, like, you know, nothing changes, guys, you know.
Who wants to pay a lot of tax, really, seriously?
Yeah, and they thought, well, hang on a minute, if we use some unmalted barley, we'll actually cut the tax bill. So, for that simple reason of trying to actually save money in tax, they began to introduce a mix of malted and unmalted barley in these great big stills that were producing a lighter style, triple distillation, to produce a purer character. And Irish whiskey, as we know it, was born. So it was this great combination of, you know, market forces and, you know, trying to avoid tax, or not avoid tax, but trying to you know, get relative tax break, that actually ended up producing the Irish whiskey style.
I think it's
which, incidentally, what was the most popular style in Scotland in the 1850s.
I think it's interesting when you look at, and I think one of the ways to understand this book is, I mean, I think more Americans have, over the last several years, taken an understanding of winemaking. And one of the reasons Mark and I are asking questions along these lines, and one of the things I do think you do a very good job with in the book, is people sort of understand that winemakers, you know, they read wine labels and they say, okay, it's a long, slow fermentation. Oh, I get that. Or I know what mountain fruit is, or cold nights and how that affects the wine. Or
yeah.
I know if something's barrel fermented that it's going to taste, have a lot of oak flavor to it. And people sort of understand a little bit of the winemaking process after all these years. And
yeah.
And I think that that what your book helps us to do is to understand the whiskey making process as well. One of the differences, though, is I think, as you said, the winemaking process is always tied to a region because the grapes grow in the ground, and the quality of what the grapes are have a huge effect year to year. Subtle differences in the grapes have a huge effect as to what the wine is going to be. I think with whiskey, it's more portable and less dependent on the annual grain harvest. You know, that's I don't think that makes a huge difference, but it is still rooted in tradition, like why Irish whiskey is a certain style. But is there any year-to-year variation due to to agriculture? Is there, like, was 1979 a better year than 1972 because of the weather? Does that affect whiskey at all?
It shouldn't, actually. The one great difference between sort of wine production and whiskey production is that the great winemakers revel in the differences between vintages, whereas in distillation, the aim is to produce the same character day in, day out, year in, year out. Lower yielding crops coming through, the distiller has to find ways of trying to retain the character and the flavour. So it is completely different to wine in that respect. I'm glad to say, I mean, I come from a wine background. You know, I started off selling wine and studying wine and, you know, helping make wine, etc. And I've always kind of approached whiskey because of that was my training, as far as tasting goes, and maybe approach goes, from that kind of wine perspective. And it always really irritates me slightly that there has been this assumption but by people that, you know, wine is all artisanal and everybody, you know, every bunch of grapes is cut with, you know, Cartier secateurs and corseted and carried in velvet cushions back to, you know, the winery and then, you know, gently persuaded to produce great liquid. Whereas, you know, spirit making is, you know, industrial and it's all about computers and pressing a button and it's not. It's equally creative. You know, it's as much about, you know, extracting flavors and understanding flavors and thinking about it in a very creative and abstract way. That's the joy of it, really, because ultimately, although you can talk about copper contact and, you know, interaction and et cetera, and esters and blah, 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 if you ask any of the chemists who are working within whiskey where flavor really comes from, they shrug their shoulders and they go, we don't know, and we don't want to know. We don't know. It's there, you know, and the magic is there. You know, you can only make Talisker at Talisker. There is just something about the magic location which genuinely affects in a very mysterious way where the flavors come from. And that applies everywhere across the world. You know, it's not just Scotland either. That magic element is so important.
Dave, I got to tell you, whenever I get slightly irritated by people not respecting whiskey and how it's made, I find that actually having a glass of whiskey will make me less irritated about that.
Always is a rule in my family, always respect the whiskey, because if not, it'll hurt you. You know, the other thing that's interesting about this book, the book is a great story. It's a great collection of stories, and also there are reviews of spirits. The thing that's struck me when reading this book is if someone had written the World Atlas of Wine, it would, their tasting notes and their flavor profiles of things, they're valid for a year. And then next year, not only is there a new vintage that's totally different than what was there before, but this year's vintage has aged a year and changed. And so the interesting thing about wine is this constant, how are you going to make any money without having to do a reprint every year? You know, it's like, but the World Atlas of Whiskey, I mean, they may introduce new products. There may be small products that come and go, but these tasting notes are valid for years to come, right?
Well, yeah, I would hope so. Yeah, I wouldn't mind another edition at some point. perhaps another reason. But you know, one of the important things, one of the points of difference about the book is that when I realised that when it's approaching it, you know, obviously you've got to have tasting notes to tell people what things, what the flavours are. But, you know, if you pick up a bottle of whiskey, and what am I looking at the moment? I am genuinely really looking at bottles of whiskey. You know, I'm looking at Highland Park, 10 years old here. You know, if you pick up a bottle of Highland Park, 10 years old, you've got the distillery character, like what the guys made in distills, plus 10 years of aging. But this book was really about what the guys are doing at the distillery, you know, what makes Highland Park Highland Park, what's the Highland Park DNA. So that's why every distillery is tasted from new makes, so the stuff that comes straight off the still, up through, its interaction and slow dance with wood. Because, you know, if you want to understand the flavour of whiskey, you've got to go right back to the source. So, I would hope that all these tasting notes would remain constant, because consistency is the key. Yeah. The one reason that a new edition will hopefully be needed is the sheer volume of new distilleries which are starting up around the world. I mean, it's extraordinary. Whiskey is just exploding around the world.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back on the other side, I do want to talk about the place of whiskey in the world and the real renaissance of brown spirits and whiskey in particular. Dave Broom is our guest. His book is The World Atlas of Whiskey, and we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC-AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com.
Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants, and also of The Restaurant Guys Radio Show.
You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to RestaurantGuysRadio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Mark and Friends, the Restaurant Guys, and we're talking about whiskey with Dave Broom. His new and wonderful book is The World Atlas of Whiskey. You can find out more about it at restaurantguysradio.com. Dave, we were talking before the break about mostly European whiskeys, but I want to talk about American whiskey. We have in the United States, we have rye, bourbon, Tennessee whiskey. But before we get into the American whiskeys, can you talk at all about the sort of the worldwide renaissance of whiskey? I mean, it was 20 years ago, vodka was king, and there were no, and brown spirits were desperately falling out of fashion, and distilleries were closing. What's going on in the world today?
It's a fascinating one. It's a new generation, really, which is growing up and wanting things with flavor. I mean, you look at the food, you know, what people are eating these days, you know, the foods tend to be slightly richer and in character. Look at the wines, which are popular, you know, that there's more flavor coming from the wines. And, you know, even within white spirits, you look at the renaissance which has happened with gin, you know, that people, I think, have seen that vodka is kind of the emperor's new clothes. You know, it's there's only so much you can talk about purity and realize it's actually no flavor. So I think people are genuinely looking for flavor. And going around the world, it's very intriguing to look at the way in which this new young generation are really taking whiskey into their lives. Go to South Africa or Japan or Taiwan or the United States. And it's young professionals. And whiskey's always been this kind of signifier for success, but you know they are genuinely wanting to discover more about it, and it counts. It's not just single malt scotch. It's you know the great renaissance that's taken place within the American whiskey market. You know, with rye suddenly reviving after years in the doldrums, with premium bourbon coming up, and then all the fascinating new craft distillers which are starting up all across the states.
Well, you know,
and then if you extrapolate that out to you know there's guys in you know, the Australian industry, whiskey industry, which is booming in Tasmania, or vast new distillery built in Taiwan, or the cult status that the Japanese single malt is acquiring all around the world. I never really think Japanese whiskey is new, but they've actually been doing it for 80 years. You know, they've just suddenly started exporting it. It really is a genuinely great time for whiskey and for this new generation who are interested in flavor.
Are distilleries opening in Scotland, in Europe? Are those regions seeing an expansion?
Or is it just the other parts of the world?
You're seeing, well, actually, last week I was up at a brand new distillery, which Diageo had just opened, called Rose Isle, which is producing over 10 million litres a year. So that's new. There's been two or three new distilleries within Scotland alone. But, you know, the main boom is taking place on continental Europe, a lot in Scandinavia. I was in one in Belgium last week. Quite a few in France. You know, almost every country in Europe will have one or two or indeed more whiskey distilleries.
Now,
sorry.
No, I was just going to say, you know, I think I want to call our discussion to a topic that is, I find really fascinating. I've done a few events with distillers. Mark and I have done a few events, whether they're classes or catered events or fundraisers. And among the Scottish single malt guys, the cocktail is a dirty word, you know. And among American whiskey producers, they're like, put my whiskey in a cocktail, you know. unless it's, you know, obviously you're not going to take a $100 bottle of whiskey and make a whiskey sour out of it.
Yeah.
What is the attitude among whiskey producers, and obviously understanding that we're never going to take the top, most expensive whiskey and put it in a cocktail, but with the rebirth of the cocktail in America and the monstrous wave of cocktails across the world, what is the attitude of the old world distillers to cocktails?
To the old world distillers, I don't think can quite still get their heads around the idea. Certainly the single malt, they really don't see why you should put in a cocktail. I think it's slightly different when you get to blended whiskey, and they're beginning to understand that whiskey can be enjoyed in a whole number of different ways. Even a very simple mixer, you know, that's kind of what blended Scotch whiskey is about. You know, simple mix of ginger ale or green tea or coconut water or whatever. So that is beginning, but I do think that there's always been a greater acceptance of whiskey as, let's face it, guys, just a drink. It's a great flavored drink, you know. But you know, as an ingredient within cocktails within America, it is one aspect of whiskey which I really, really wish that the old world whiskey distillers actually cottoned on to, because it would help things immensely.
You know, it's funny because with some of these less expensive blended scotches or Irish whiskeys, and scotches especially, people, you know, will say, well, you know, sort of look at you askance. We did a dinner once, and I wanted to use one of the inexpensive whiskeys from this distiller in a cocktail, and I got the definite, yeah, we're not really comfortable with that. and it was going to be a great, great cocktail. And, you know, we're doing a dinner, and our guests would have loved it, but they were definitely not, didn't want that message sent out with their brand. And the American distillers, I think, would answer the question of, hey, do you want me to put your whiskey in a cocktail? And I think their question back would be, are you going to pay for it? And I'd say yes, and they'd say, okay, put it in a cocktail.
You know? I don't know. I think there are some, you know, certainly, you know, I think the folks from Compass Box and things like that have more embraced the cocktail culture than some of the other brands. You know, it depends on the producer, I think.
Yeah, I think. I mean, John's a fantastic guy who you know, understands the world work, and you know, he's passionate. You know, I've known John for years, you know, and every time we meet, we always kind of bang on about the same thing, you know, which is, you know, it's flavor that's king, you know, and if people are into, you know, the reason that people buy whiskey is because they like the taste, you know. And if they like the taste, then give them as many different flavor opportunities as you can. If that means mixing with it, then yeah, go ahead and do it. You know, it's stupid not to. There's the point of difference. One of the great points of difference between American distillers and Scotch distillers, and maybe that's one of the ways that American whiskey can establish itself around the world again. So.
Well, let's talk about American whiskey, and we only have a few minutes left, but I think people are fascinated by the different kinds of American whiskey. Obviously, when we talk about a rye, that's a whiskey that's made from, well, rye. That's the base grain. And when we talk about bourbon and Tennessee whiskey, those are made from corn as the base grain. But I think people are a little confused about bourbon and Tennessee whiskey, and what's the difference between those two whiskeys, a Jack Daniel's Tennessee whiskey versus a Maker's Mark bourbon. What makes Tennessee whiskey Tennessee whiskey?
I think a lot of people think that Jack Daniel's is a bourbon.
Right.
Yeah. Well, the difference between the simple difference between Tennessee whiskey and bourbon is that Tennessee whiskey has to be filtered through maple charcoal after it has been distilled, and that kind of charcoal mellowing process, which is used at you know, Jack Daniel's and George Bickel, softens the whiskey down. It's almost like, you know, it's almost like going back to that kind of copper conversation thing again. You know, the charcoal actually acts as another way of removing any of kind of the heavier elements that you get in new spirit. So that's a simple difference between Tennessee whiskey and bourbon. You know, the mash bill's the same. You know, it's predominantly corn, so some, you know, minimum 51%, but more than that. It's got to be aged in brand new, you know, heavily charred oak barrels. But it's that filtering process that takes place after distillation that sets Tennessee whiskey apart. The other thing that people tend to think, you know, because Jack has got sour mash on the label. I think this is an assumption that, that it's the sour mashing that, that actually makes a difference. But I say every single bourbon is sour mash.
Will you explain to us what a sour mash is and why they would use that in Tennessee and Kentucky?
Yeah, the reason for sour mashing really is to, from a chemical point of view, is to help fermentation, actually, because you've got hard water in there. And certain, the ferment, to have a more active and controlled fermentation, you need slightly more acidic environment in for the yeast to grow. So you need to acidify your wash or the fermenting liquid. So sour mashing is basically all the liquid which is left after the alcohol has been driven off the still, you've collected all the alcohol. You're left with all the residue, the liquid residue at the bottom of your still. That is very acidic. And that is your sour mash. And that is what you're taking and you're putting back into your fermenter, adjusting the pH of the fermentation. It's allowing the yeast to act in a much easier, much more controlled way, and it helps produce flavour. So
what does it do?
It's a very, very old technique. I wonder whether the guys in Jamaica have been using it for, I suspect, longer than the guys in Kentucky and Tennessee. I wonder whether it's a rum technique that was kind of adapted by early distillers in Kentucky, but there's no evidence for that. It's a very, very old technique. And it's one way that distillers get around issues and potential problems.
What flavors are produced from a sour mash?
All bourbon is sour mash. It would be interesting. And I think now, who did it? I think Chris Morris did. They tried to do non-sour mashed at either LeBrun Graham. I think it was either LeBrun Graham or Early Times Distilleries, just to see what would happen. And he said it was, it was almost impossible. It was very hard to get the fermentation started. It was really tough. They were producing different aromas that they didn't necessarily want. So it was just incredibly tough. But now given they all are, and there aren't any which aren't that sour mash, it's kind of hard to say what flavors would be produced.
So, does a Tennessee whiskey need to be produced in the state of Tennessee, and does a bourbon need to be produced in the state of Kentucky?
Bourbon can be produced anywhere in the U.S. The Tennessee whiskey does have its own regulations controlling it, involving that Lincoln County process, which is, other words for the charcoal mellowing. But you can make bourbon anywhere in the United States.
But Tennessee whiskey has to be in Tennessee, or if I use that charcoal mellowing process, can I make Tennessee whiskey in Idaho?
I suppose you could say you're making Tennessee whiskey in Idaho. I think if you're in Idaho using that process, I think you would rather call it Idaho whiskey.
All right, so let's go from Idaho whiskey to, I think, one of my favorite new whiskeys that has blown my mind, that I love, is, and you mentioned the guy in your book, but you don't talk a lot about his whiskey, is the Stranahan's Colorado whiskey.
Oh, it's great.
Have you had that?
Yeah, I talked about it. Chatted with him. Yeah, it was unfortunate. I'm stuck with a certain number of pages, there wasn't more time to talk about the craft distillers in America. But Stranahan's, I was very, very impressed with. There's a lot of really, really seriously good whiskies coming out from the craft distillers across America. Stranahan's is certainly up there, and substantially different to the big names from Kentucky and Tennessee, which is commercially makes perfect sense because what small distiller wants to take on Jack Daniels?
Yeah, exactly. And that whiskey, I think, is really its own thing, and he's the only guy doing that out in Colorado, and so he's pushing it as Colorado whiskey, which I think is really cool. But there's also a return to, there was, of course, a distilling tradition in the Northeast that has sort of fallen away over the years for a number of different historical reasons. But there's, you cover Tuttletown Spirits in your book, which is a Hudson Valley distiller. What can you say about the Hudson Valley and the new New York micro distilleries?
Artisanal distilling. It's these guys who. It's quite interesting when you talk to the vast majority of the new distillers anywhere in the world, that the inspiration for starting a distillery usually starts with a bunch of them sitting around.
By the way, if it's 4 o'clock, Dave, if it's 4 o'clock in the morning, they're sitting around with an empty bottle of single malt.
Yeah, oh, exactly. Yes. You know, we've all had kind of that discussion, but you know, occasionally somebody actually gets up and does it. And what impresses me about guys, you know, like the Enzo's at Tuttletown, is that they set out not just to replicate what else was on the market. They wanted to find their own style and create something which was expressive of themselves, their approach, their attitude, perhaps their environment or whatever. And that is what I think is driving the whole renaissance sort of craft distilling around the world. Is that these guys aren't simply copyists. They're trying to find unique ways of making their whiskies different. You know, compare Tuttletown, for example, to Stranahan's, then compare both of them to something like St. George or Charbet out in California, you know, which are wonderfully lifted and elegant and fragrant and, you know, incredibly perfumed. And you think, are these whiskies? Well, yeah, they are whiskies. They're just out there somewhere. You know, they're out in this wonderful new area. So the sheer variety and quality of distillates which is coming out is really heartening to see.
And one of the most exciting things you can do now with this book that's really amazing is that you really can't do with wine. I mean, you can do it to a certain extent, but by the time a wine book goes to press, you have some time that has passed, and whatever the author tasted has changed. And maybe the vintage has changed, or maybe the wine's just a year older. But it's really very difficult to use a book to describe wine because, well, you know, maybe that Sancerre that's supposed to taste a certain way, and you've opened it at home, and it's corked, or it's off, or it's not behaving like a Sancerre normally behaves. And so there are issues
Or it's just going through an awkward period. I mean, that happens in wine all the time.
And you have in wine exams, usually when they give a blind tasting exam to if you're going for some sort of a degree in wine, someone who has that degree sits in the exam to make sure that wine is showing typicity that day, that wine is behaving typically. The thing about these spirits is they're stable, they're always the same, and you can use this book to compare and contrast side by side, look at the tasting notes in the book, and the opportunity to teach yourself about whiskey with this book is really unprecedented. And it's if you really want to learn about whiskey, you can actually go to the store and buy what it says, try them side by side, see what Dave has to say about it, see whether you agree or disagree. And it's a very useful book.
And the only thing you have to worry.
Thanks for that. I mean, that was one of the reasons putting things in flavor camps, and then you know you go to the back of the book, and you know everything is listed by those flavor camps. So, you know, you can just write it down on a piece of paper and go to your local store, your local bar, and see if I'm right or not. But you know that's the point. I mean, it's you know hopefully whiskey geeks will get something new from it as well, but it won't be too daunting for this whole new generation of people who are interested in whiskey. It'll kind of lead them gently into this fascinating world of flavor and allow them to explore it with a little bit more confidence. But it's so daunting to walk into a bar and be faced with, like, you know, 200 bottles staring at you, and you go, well, I had something that nice called Glen. I'll try something else called Glen because it might be similar. You know, hopefully this is a little route map for them.
And remember, the only thing when you drink whiskey, the only thing you have to worry about behaving badly are your friends.
Hey, Dave, thank you for coming on the show.
You're not at all. It's been a pleasure, guys.
Dave Broom joins us from his home in England, where he talks about his new book, The World Atlas of Whiskey. You can find out more about Dave and his book at our website, restaurantguysradio.com. And we'll be back in just a minute. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTCAM and restaurantguysradio.com. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys.
Francis, in the last segment, mentioned a couple of really cool distilleries, the Stranahan's Colorado Whiskey and Tuttletown, which is up in New York. Two really cool American distilleries doing some really cool, interesting, and different types of whiskeys. But what I'll say is we didn't talk about what may be my new favorite whiskey.
What is that? Why don't I know this?
Are
we growing apart? Why do I not know this?
There's a whiskey that's just become available in the United States.
Oh, I do know this.
It is. It for a while now, we've been getting a whiskey called Red Breast 12-year-old.
Mark can't say breast. It makes him nervous. Red Breast is an Irish whiskey. It's the only pot-stilled Irish whiskey available in America.
Really, really wonderful. And I've always been a fan of the Red Breast 12-year-old. I got it out that time. I've really been a fan. But they've just released a 15-year-old, which has just become available in the United States.
Super limited. I mean, we had a wrestle for the case
it
we got.
It is super delicious, though.
Oh my God.
It is just so rich and
well, let me tell you something
delicious.
Out there. I Redbreast is the Irish whiskey I drink at home. You know, that's an endorsement, right? It's the whiskey I drink at home. And I shower with Irish Spring in the morning.
Imagine me bringing an Irish whiskey. To
I
the
know
table,
that's how good it is, right? The Redbreast was it the 12-year-old is Redbreast 12-year-old is widely available and just such a phenomenally good value in whiskey. I mean, Jameson is very good, you know, but
probably liquor store price, I'm going to say, is $50-$55 for the 12.
It's a phenomenal, it may be the best value, I think it may be the best value in whiskey in America. But the new 15-year-old that they just released, which is in a limited quantity.
And is only maybe $10, $15 more than the 12-year-old.
God, it's amazing.
It's crazy good.
So we only got 6 bottles for the restaurant, and I took 2 of them home. So that's 4 bottles for the restaurant.
You know, you didn't mention that you had taken 2 of them home.
You knew. Come on.
I knew you were because I know Francis Schott, and I know his little escapades.
I know. It's funny because Mark and I taste everything before it comes in, everything. But we didn't taste this because we trust the house very well. And well, if we didn't like it, we just send it back. But I wanted that allocation. And when it came in, oh my goodness, it's great. I would really, I'd recommend it very highly, Redbreast Irish Whiskey. I recommend this book very highly, The World Atlas of Whiskey by David Broom. If you want to teach yourself something about whiskey, and the thing about it is, whiskey is constant, you know, and that just, it makes it so much easier in a way to learn about whiskey because it's not a move, you know, wine is a moving target and whiskey isn't. And I hope that you guys make your resolution this New Year's to learn as much about whiskey as you possibly can. Hope you've enjoyed the hour with the Restaurant Guys as much as we have. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys on WCTC AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com.